is Wednesday, the July the 17th, 2002, and Joe Arnett is going to be talking on plant life of the North Cascades, symbiosis and change. This is session three. It's entitled The Beauty and Diversity of Flowers. And this is tape number ARJ-2002-09. So let's join Joe with the rest of the people in there and discussion.
That's a clue to the tape room that they run the tape, so anything that you want to keep confidential, don't take now. It'll be recorded forever. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Joe Arnett, and I'm serving the village this week and next, and last week as the village botanist. So my job is to help you learn whatever you'd like to learn about plants. And I always like to start with the acknowledgement that we're really looking at an infinite subject, and so we have an hour to sort of take a little bite at learning. And there's always more to learn. And I learn something every time that I, you know, look at the topic or look at the plants. And so we'll learn what we can in an hour. Before I start, I'll also just tell you that there's a lot of great references around. And there's two in particular that I'd like to recommend. And I'll show you what those are. The first one is, if you're interested specifically in trees, this is a great little book called Northwest Trees by Stephen Arnold. It includes trees in Washington, Oregon, southern British Columbia. I think it goes all the way into Montana a little ways. Yeah, into across the northern part of Idaho. But it has a key to identification, and it has a lot of information about species, ecology of species, and uses. So it's a great little book. There's a couple of copies in the bookstore. The current printing has a different cover, but it's the same book. And then another one, which is also in the bookstore, it's called Plants of the Pacific Northwest Coast by Pojar and McKenna. And it's a great field guide for beginners or intermediate people, even professional botanists. I don't use this now. It's a really great picture guide, but it's organized by families, which is very important if you get very far into identifying plants. Things are organized by families. And it includes flowering plants as well as conifers and mosses. It's a great book, very widely used. I don't know if there's anybody here that has a technical interest, but if you do, this is the sort of the Bible of the Pacific Northwest for plants, called Flora of the Pacific Northwest. And it's a condensation of a five-volume set, which is very comprehensive. It includes all the species that we know of in the Northwest. And so, does anybody have technical interest in botany? All right, I won't dwell on that one. It's not easy to learn to use. It's like learning to speak a new language. Got all the technical terminology, and also because it's a condensation, everything is abbreviated. So you also have to learn the abbreviations. So great references, and of course the best reference is the plants themselves. Just go out and look, and that's always a good place to start. As a way of introduction, I'll just put up this classification outline, sort of to show you what the plan is for the week and where we are in that plan. If we start with basic questions like what's a plant, the answer to that may not be as simple as you think, because by modern classification, plants don't include fungi, which were traditionally considered in the study of botany. And they also don't include protista, which include algae, which were traditionally included in the study of botany. So plants really are just these types of organisms here. And the biggest subdivision in these is the vascular plants, which is what I've studied. I really have only studied plants that have tissue specialized for transport of water and nutrient. So that includes conifers, flowering plants, ferns, horsetails. There's another group of plant called bryophytes, which don't have specialized tissue, and they're much smaller, and it's a very diverse group too, but I don't know anything about those really.
But what do all the cryptogams have in common?
Cryptogams, all that means is that the gametes are born in structures that are more or less microscopic. So all of these have seeds. These are seed-producing plants, the ones that aren't cryptogams. And the seed-producing plants are the conifers and the flowering plants. And these all are spore-producing. So that's just another, they sort of overlap. They're not perfect, perfectly parallel systems. But. So this week, the first day we looked at conifers, which are the dominant type of plants around here. All these trees, all the trees except the cottonwoods. I think all the big trees are conifers right around the village. And looked at identifying them, and then looked at how the different conifers arrange themselves by elevation in the mountains here. And then today, we're going to look at flowering plants right here. And flowering plants are by far the greatest part of the diversity of plants that we find. For a couple examples, I did a study for a couple years over on Sawtooth Ridge, which is across the lake, and we identified something like 665 species and varieties of vascular plants. Of those 665, probably about 600 of them are flowering plants. And there's just a very small number of, there's about 16 conifers and around a dozen ferns and horsetails. So by far, almost everything with all the diversity we see is flowering plants. Another example, in the state of Washington, there's something like, something on the order of 3,500 species of vascular plants. So that's a lot. And probably, well, over 3,000 of those would be flowering plants. So there's a lot. That's what I always like to say. We really are looking at an infinite subject. So you kind of take it where you are, you know, and just to understand the difference between conifers and flowering plants, maybe that's an accomplishment. So that's where we'll start. And today, looking at flowers, my goals for this hour are to just look at the general structure of a flower. What is a flower? What are the parts of it? There's four main parts. And then show you some of the variation in how those parts might arrange themselves. And some of the differences between, you know, each of those 3,000 flowering plants in Washington, or each of those 600 some flowering plants that might be around in the open area. We spent several months crawling over the ground, which you may not be interested in doing, but if you did, in there, if old ended up in the high country around here and down to the lake, there's something on the order of 600 species that we might encounter. And all these have some variation of these four main parts. And this is titled A Complete Flower. We use that term, there's a bunch of terminology in biology, which is why some people may not like it. But we use that term complete to mean it has all of these four parts: stamens, pistils, corolla, and calyx. There's lots of incomplete flowers too that don't have all four parts. But I'm just going to explain what these are. And to start with the central part of the flower is really the ovary, which contains the ovules, which are going to develop into new seeds, contain new individuals ultimately. The style, which is usually elongate, and the stigma, which is the portion of the pistil, which is what this is all called together, the portion of the pistil that is receptive to pollen. So pollen eventually lands on the stigma and actually germinates, just like a little seed. And it germinates into which is really a generation of the life cycle of a plant. Well, I won't get into alternation of generations too much, but it germinates, grows down through the style, which is sometimes an opportunity for competition. There may be hundreds of pollen grains that germinate and start to grow, so it's kind of a race to see which is the strongest that's going to make it into the ovary. another function of the style is to put the stigma out in a place where it can receive pollen. And sunflower plants are pollinated by wind, and the style puts that stigma out where the wind, where it can comb the wind. But most flowering plants are pollinated by insects. So that's the female part, the pistil. That's an L right there, the overhead loss of this. It looks like it's two eyes, but it's not. Yeah. And then the male part is a little simpler, like males tend to be. And it only has two parts. It has a filament, which is the stalk, which places the anthers, which is where pollen is produced. And together, those are called the stamen. Then there's two, those are really the working parts of flowers. And every flowering plant, either on one individual or on separate individuals, has to have both male and female just to produce seeds which are new genetic configurations. Kind of like what the whole thing is about. This is like the flowers part, you know, the birds and the bees and the flowers. And so then there's two other things, two other parts of the flower which serve to protect the developing flower or that serve to act as an attractant to a pollinator. Flowering plants developed as reproductive structures that were pollinated by insects. That's what we think anyway. The ancestral flowers were insect pollinated. And so the attraction of to attract the insects is usually carried out by the corolla, which is usually the showy part of the flower. I should, let me get a marker here. I want to write something on the board here. Wizard of Oz, you know, behind the screen. This little word, usually, is a very important one, and I use that, I'll say that a lot. It's abbreviated like this, USU. In almost everything I say, there's exceptions. And so that's the way biology is, that there's all these variations on this theme. So almost everything I have to say is usually. The corolla usually serves the function of attracting the pollinator. But sometimes that function is taken up by something else. And the corolla is made up of petals. It's a good common term, but also a technical term. If we pick off one of these things off this daisy and we call it a petal, that's the technical term too. You know, that's a petal. And when we get to this, there's actually more to the daisy story than that, but that's the corolla. And the other part that usually serves to protect the flower is the calyx, which is usually greenish and composed of sepals or sepals. So those are the four parts. And any flower we have that has stamens, pistils, calyx, and corolla is a complete flower. Okay, are you with me so far? So this is a stylized diagram. And what I'd like to do next is to show you some slides of different forms that these four parts take. Does everyone have one of these handouts to look at?
No.
You want one? Yeah, why don't you take one of these? Sure. Everybody else have one? Because what I'll do, I'll show you the slides and I'll refer to these four terms, stamens, pistils, calyx, corolla. And so you might want to look at the diagram to keep track of that if it's new terminology.
Yeah. Would you generally say that they usually, the sepals are the protection they provide is to support the petals, or is it protection against the environment?
I think it's more when the flower bud is starting to open that it serves protection of that. That's the usual case. Yeah.
Is there a particular part where the fragrance is usually captured or manufactured or whatever you would say?
You know, actually, I don't know the answer to that. I know that this isn't just the old teacher's trick. If you don't know the answer to the question, you answer another question. So I don't know where the fragrance is produced. Now that you mention it, I never even thought of that. There are nectaries, which are little structures within the flower, which sometimes are modified, either stamens or pistils, or sometimes they're just structures that develop, but there are visible structures that produce nectar sometimes. And there's probably the same thing with producing this scent.
You have the word receptacle on here. It's on here, it's not on there.
Right. Receptacle, by definition, these are the four parts of the flower. This is the receptacle. And this is just like the end of the stalk or the end of the stem where all these other four parts are attached. That's a good point, because I might, I'm not sure if I have any pictures in here that show it, but I might refer to the receptacle, which is, you know, the point of attachment. There's another part on that isn't on here because it isn't a part of what's technically a flower, but often there are leaves associated with flowers, and the leaves are often specially adapted or modified for some purpose. And I'll use this term quite a bit, which is just a bract. And a bract is by definition just a leaf, or a modified leaf. And at the very last slide on this set, show some bracts, which you would probably think are petals if you didn't know better, because they serve the function of attracting pollinators. There's another term that I want to make to explain to you, because it comes up a lot, that this is a flower composed of these four parts. We also talk about inflorescences. And an inflorescence is just a bunch of flowers, or a group of flowers.
Of the same type, or?
Yeah, I'll give you an example. This daisy right here, this is what Barb was expressing her amazement about. But this is not a flower. This is an inflorescence, which is a group of flowers. Like in this daisy, there may be 100 flowers that are very tiny.
Is that the same as composite?
Yes. Well, the composite is the name for the family.
Okay. That's what I always call them.
Right.
I've never heard inflorescence before.
Well, composite is specific. This is a composite, which is the family, the daisy family or sunflower family. This right here is also an inflorescence. This whole stalk of foxglove is an inflorescence of that species. And each of these is individually a flower. Oh, there was one. There's three to four parts there, two of them, and here's the corolla, which fell off as one piece. Which, if we get a chance to, if we go really fast, we'll key this out to family. And the question that's going to be the key we'll ask is, is the corolla all one piece? Which is what this is. So this is an inflorescence, group of flowers, and so is this, a daisy. Different families, but that's what inflorescence means. Any other questions so far before we jump?
I was just kind of curious about the daisy, and I don't really remember. So what we see here as petals, are they actually bracts? Because it's a collection of flowers? So actually,
I'll show you a breakdown, a diagram of that family. Here I have a ruler here. Here we go. This is the sunflower family, or the aster family, or the composites, like you said, known as composites. That's going to stick with it. Kind of moving in slow motion. But if we take this head, which the term head is a technical term for this kind of inflorescence, where the flowers are compacted together, and each of these little pieces, if we dissect this, which I'll give you a chance after, if we make it through the slides, you'll see that there's two kinds of flowers in there. And this is a flower, which has the corolla. That's in this case, it's going to be yellow in the center. And it has the calyx, which is modified into these bristles. You know, like dandelion seeds, how they get carried on the wind with that little parachute? Well, that's the calyx, that parachute. It's a modification of the calyx. And then inside the flower, this is the style of the pistil with the stigma up at the top. And these are the stamens that arrange themselves in a ring. So this is a very highly specialized adaptation of that diagram I showed you of a flower. And so this is a flower. And it's called a disc flower because it forms the disc in the center. And the white ones are called ray flowers. And this is a diagram of a ray flower. It has this real elongate part of the corolla. And then it has the same thing, the calyx modified into these bristles. This is the stigma right here, the style. And down at the very bottom is the ovary, which will develop into the seed. You ever picked apart a sunflower, the head of a sunflower, and you find the sunflower seeds with the remnants of the flower up on top. So that's that flower.
So that old thing about you must be not.
You're well,
not
I don't. I never would do that with a gazing because you've taken a big gamble. I don't know what's going to happen.
But each one is a flower.
Each one is a flower, yeah. I'll show you a picture. Any other questions before I turn them on? Let's please if I can come by you guys here. Pictures on. Let's turn this. I'll jump across here, I guess. Turn this off. There's several characteristics that we'll look at, and one of them is the number of floral parts. And the most common number is 5. So this is a flower right here, and it's a little bit hard to see it on this individual, but you can see there's 5 petals. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And they're divided or lobed. But there's 5 petals. So this is a good plant to do that. She loves you. She loves me. She loves me not. And you can see the another characteristic we look at besides the floral, the number of parts, is whether or not they're fused into a single structure. Like this is the calyx. Remember, the calyx is one of the 4 parts made of sepals or sepals. And they're fused into a tube. So that's one variation on how floral parts can be modified. They can be fused together into a tube. But another example is they may still be separate. This is just for your information. This is called catch fly. And this particular species is a subalpine, high mountain species. But there are garden species that are in the same genus that they're also called catchfly. This is a type of saxifrage. This is an alpine saxifrage which grows up at high elevation. It's only about an inch tall, the plant, very small. But if you look at the flowers, you see that every one of them has 5 petals. So that floral number is one of the characteristics we look at. If you look at any flower, to see how many petals does it have. Also might ask how many stamens does it have, and you see these little orange specks here. And probably there were originally 10, because things tend to come in multiples, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, There's an extra one, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Well, this one does have 10. You might lose one or two, so they might not always have 10. But that's another characteristic we look at. See, this one, the petals are each separate. They're not fused together. Sometimes the number of parts is not a definite number. This is a type of Lewisia called Tweedy's Lewisia. I'm going to have to go by it. But Lewisia doesn't have like just 5 or just 3 parts. They're just an indefinite number. Like this one, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah, I guess they're all 8, the ones that are showing there. So that's another variation on numbers, numbers of parts. This is another one that has an indefinite number. It's not 5 or 6 or 4, but sort of an indefinite. I think if we counted these, they would all be a little different. This is called wind flower, and another thing that's unique about this is that the function of the different parts can be interchanged. These things aren't petals. These things that look like petals, these are actually the sepals of the calyx. But in this particular species, or this particular genus, there are no petals. Petals have been lost through adaptation, and the sepals have taken on that role of attracting the pollinator. This is also called wind flower or past flower because it flowers in the spring.
Joe, this might be a dumb question, but how do you know that those are the calyx and not?
Not the corolla. It's not a dumb question at all. And I actually, that's not a dumb question at all. And I had the same one. Originally, the way I figured that out is I would look in the book and see if the calyx or the corolla is absent. It's sort of a technical determination based on where the parts are arranged. But I subsequently learned that it's a rule of thumb that if a part is missing, it's the corolla that's missing.
Huh. Is that an insect that's in the one of them?
Right here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like it. I can't see it well enough to know what insect it is. But you know these. These are also alpine species, and a lot of times the environment in that flower is much more favorable to insects than outside, because it might be warmer, might concentrate the sunlight, and so you see a lot of insects that might just be spending time in the flowers because it's a good place to be.
But you're already saying if there's no calyx, or it looks like there's no calyx, and it looks like there's petals, then the petals are actually the calyx.
That's the rule of thumb.
Like, isn't it the lily that doesn't have?
Well, the lilies are another case.
They don't have a calyx.
The lilies are a specialized case where the calyx and the corolla are identical. And so they...
Yeah, because it's kind of greenish at the bottom and then it turns to color.
Right.
Okay.
So in the lily family, they don't use the term calyx and corolla. They use the term, or they don't use the term petals and sepals. They call them both tepals with a T, because they're not, they can't be distinguished. And I'll show you here, there's some pictures here of members of the lily family. This is just to show you another case where, this is on the theme of floral parks, numbers of floral parks. This is a cactus, a hedgehog cactus. That we have in Washington called Simpson's Hedgehog Cactus. And it has an indefinite number of petals. You know, we could count them, but they're not 5 or 6 like the lilies. And it has an indefinite number of stamens. That's what the bright orange is. There might be 100 stamens in there. And it has a single pistil in the middle. I don't know if you can pick it out from the photo. And these parts may also be modified into some specialized shape. It's not just the number. It's a close-up of the same thing. Lots of petals, indefinite number of petals, indefinite number of stamens, and a single pistil. I might just keep you guys from falling asleep. It's dark in the room. It's really bad in the afternoon. We have a lot high attrition rate. So, floral number. In fact, let me write these. These are sort of the variables in this flower theme. One would be number of parts. Another might be fusion of parts, whatever those parts might be.
Is there anything that distinguishes whether or not they're pollinated by wind or by insects? It's just
usually something pollinated by the wind doesn't have any need for showy floral parts.
Oh, okay.
And so usually wind-pollinated plants are have very small flowers that are born in big clusters.
Like a grass.
Like a grass or a willow. A lot of the trees are flowering plants like maples and oaks, but they're pollinated by the wind, so they don't have to, there's no advantage to showy flowers. So that's a generality, but that's usually the case. This is a, I put this in because it's kind of a an oddity, and I realized that it's not a good example of what I was trying to show you relative to, I'm going to have to go back and focus this again. If you don't mind, that'd be great.
The, this large now?
Yeah. Some of the projectors have an autofocus, but this one doesn't. The other
There we
go. I think go a little further even that way.
A little further? See, I need my eyeglasses adjusted too. So
there, that's pretty good.
Perfect.
That's good. This is in the iris family, and it's characterized by having floral parts in multiples of three also. But this particular plant is an odd one because it has these stripes. This is called Sisyrinchium, and it was the only one I've ever seen that had these stripes. So I took some photos of it, and then I didn't realize until I put it on the screen here that it also has more petals than it ought to have, according to my ideas, anyway. So usually this family has floral parts in multiples of three. And this has like an eight in there, isn't it? So it's kind of an oddball. This is a little bit dark to see. I'll turn this off. This is a lily called chocolate lily. And it's a rare plant in Washington. It's a common plant in Alaska. And I like to think of it as the dark chocolate lily, because it's so dark. But you can see in this one, the floral parts are in threes. Remember you asked about the lilies? What about the lilies? Well, this has got six tepals. And if you can see inside, it has three, the floral parts inside, the ovary is also divided in three. So it has three stigmas. So those are classic lily characteristics. Chocolate lily. This was an important food plant for native people in Alaska. Down here, I don't think this species is common enough because it's a rare plant, but this one, which is also called chocolate lily, is quite common here. This was taken along Lake Chelan. And see, it has tepals in multiples of three, or six. This one is sort of like the white chocolate or the milk chocolate. Just a little bit of an aside, this the structure of the flower and the way it's arranged is an adaptation for pollination by a particular insect. And you'll see some other examples too of this drooping character. The flowers hang down so that only certain insects can fly up, particularly bees, and get at them. After this has been pollinated and the fruit starts to develop, the stalk will straighten back up again. And we'll find the seed capsules on straight stems. And that's a common characteristic in different families.
Is this related to, like, Lily of the Valley? There just looks like there's a lot of resemblance.
It's in the same family. They're both in the lily family. This is in the genus Fritillaria. And Lily of the Valley is in the genus Myanthus. And these are the western Lily of the Valley. But very similar floral parts with the same numbers. The calyx and the corolla are the same, so they call them tepals. You can't tell them apart. This is another one. This is a camas lily. This is another very important food plant. It was and is for native people.
See the bulb?
Yeah, the bulb was dug and eaten, dug and roasted in huge numbers, huge quantities. It still is. In modern times, it's more of a traditional, or almost a ritual food gathering, where they probably, you know, most people buy most of their food in the grocery store, but they still gather camas bulbs in the spring. Or actually, I think they gather them later in the summer when the flowers are gone. It's another picture of it, same species. Floral parts in threes, multiples of three. So you can see there's six stamens here. This one's out of focus, but there's six stamens, six tepals, and the ovary is three-parted.
The stamen and the lily always yellow.
Well,
dark, and they stain. Usually floral decorators will cut those off.
Oh, is that right?
I got on a white tablecloth when it closed me.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
aren't they orange sometimes too?
I meant orange.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay, so floral number. I don't know if you can see this with the lights off, but number of parts. And then another variable is fusion of parts. This is a gentian called bark gentian, which is very common here in the subalpine meadows. Flowers late in the summer. And when the gentian starts to flower, we know that summer is nearly over. It's kind of the signal that summer is coming to an end. But this is where the corolla is fused into a tube in the gentian family. And the calyx is green and not too distinct at the bottom.
Is that used medicinally to make gentian violet?
I don't know. It kind of makes sense that the name would come from them,
yeah.
But I don't know if that is the case. Now here's two sagebrush species. This is called bluebells. This is called yellowbells. And these are both pollinated by bees, by bumblebees. Bees tend to like Cub Scout colors, blue and yellow. And they also are very adept at getting to flowers that are hanging. And so it's a way of excluding, sort of keeping out the riffraff, you know, I guess is a way of looking at it, excluding other insects. And here's a fused corolla. The petals are separate at the very tip, but most of the length of the corolla is a tube. The calyx has also been fused at the base, but separate at the tip. So this is in the borage family. We can't really see from this view the characteristics of that family, but this is in the lily family, and it's got separate tepals. They aren't fused into two, but they both have this hanging stature so that as an adaptation for pollination. This is another one that once the pollination is done, it'll stand up. This is also the borage family. And I won't go into family characteristics too much because it's such a big topic. One time I thought that a great presentation would be to cover 50 families in an hour. I thought, well, I was going to give a class to a group of people that were studying restoration. And so I took it on myself to describe 50 families an hour, thinking there might be a real career there. And it was total overload. And now we're lucky, we might look at one family tonight. or today rather this morning. But I will say, this is called showy stick seed, and it's probably the rarest plant in Washington. It's only found in a very small area of a few acres along Tumwater Canyon near Leavenworth.
And it's endangered?
It was recently formally designated as endangered by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But floral parts in threes, and fives rather, five petals. You can't see it in this picture, but it's fused, the lower part is fused into a tube. And this constriction or these bumps at the throat of the flower is another family characteristic. You know forget-me-nots, which are blue and have a yellow center? Well, that's also a borage. And this part of the petal is blue, and this is called the fornix, is yellow. So that gives it that two-colored appearance.
How do you spell it?
Spell
borage?
Fornix?
Borage.
Oh, borage. B-O-R-A-G-E.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, it's a shooting star and very specialized flower arrangement. Still has separate petals, and there are five. It has five sepals. You can see the calyx right here. And this, right at the very tip, is the stigma. And these dark structures are the stamens. And this is also pollinated by bees, where the bees are able to come up from below. And once the pollination, this is another one, that once the pollination is complete, then the flowering stalk will straighten up and grow up straight. And I guess that's so that for distribution of seed, if it's up higher, it just is a better mechanism for getting the seed distributed. There's a close-up of the same thing. I think there's five petals. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The stamens, and there's a stigma, it's just the very tip of the style. Okay, here's my one quiz question. What do you think these are?
Calyx.
No, these are bracts, modified leaves. Yeah, the sepals are actually invisible behind the petals. Well, this is a heather. This is a Peak Mountain heather.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. And you can see the corolla fused into a bell shape, and this is the style extending out. And at the very tip is the stigma. So it's out there so a visiting bee would come in contact with that. Some of these bell-shaped flowers have what's called buzz pollination, where the bee will hang on the flower and buzz, and that vibration will cause the pollen to shake loose and come and land on his chest. And then when it goes on her chest, because it's a working bee, and when it goes to the next flower, then it'll come in contact with the stigma. It always amazes me that pollination works as well as it does. You know, you look at nature and you think it's such a long shot that some insect is going to visit one flower, get the pollen in just the right place, visit another flower, and achieve this pollination. But
it's a different species. Then does the pollen germinate and produce the pollen?
There's different barriers. In some cases, actually, this is a great place to ask it because I'm going to show you a hybridization. Sometimes there's chemical signals that tell the pollen to germinate, that it's in the right place to germinate. And so a lot of times the pollen won't germinate anywhere unless it's on the right species. Sometimes there's other barriers, like after pollination happens, after fertilization happens, then the product of fertilization will abort. That would be a waste, yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's other barriers, like the insect behavior is such that it won't visit.
Yeah.
It'll specialize on one.
But you see bees going, like in my garden, you see them going from one flower to the next, they don't care, usually.
Well, bumblebees actually, if you watch them, it's not absolute, but they tend to specialize. They'll tend to check out what's producing nectar that day and go to the same species.
Oh, they're just checking them out.
They might be, yeah. But
doing a scouting mission.
But just to show you, look at the shape of this corolla. See how it's kind of an open bell? And the color is kind of a deep pink. If you look at this one, this is the same genus. The genus is Philodacy. It's the heather, mountain heather. But see how what the shape of this flower is? It's very got a narrow opening, very tiny opening, and it's yellow. This is yellow mountain heather. And they grow in slightly different habitats, but if they come in contact, you often see hybrids. And this is a hybrid between those two. It's kind of a pale pink, but it's got the flower shape of the yellow one. See the narrow opening? And this is one case where it's a common example of hybridization. But you don't see very, you only see these hybrids right where both parents are present. And they don't seem to extend into the habitat of either parent.
So are the hybrids fertile?
I don't think these are. In some cases, hybrids are fertile. And you start getting a mixing of species. But
how do these things develop? You've got to have certain insects to pollinate certain flowers.
Right.
And you wonder how they got that way, you know. Whether the insect was there and the flower gradually changed or how that all works.
I know. It's one of those sort of marvelous and intricate, wonderful things about nature. But the thing I think about when I think of that kind of question is that they've both been changing in response to each other for a long time. You know, early our plants were probably pollinated by beetles, and they were probably kind of big, messy flowers. And the beetles were eating the flowers, and somehow in that process of eating the flowers, they started carrying out pollination. And so since then, there's been this radiation into different forms. And the flowers really tell you quite a bit about the nature of the insect, of both the structure and the nervous system, what kinds of things the insect likes. Like bees like the colors yellow and blue. And so those flowers that were yellow and blue would get pollinated more readily. So this is kind of, at least the way we understand it, there's this long, slow process of the bee and the flower adapting to each other.
What pollinizes these?
These are pollinated by bees. And they carry out that buzz pollination where they hang on the bell of the flower and buzz and collect the pollen that way.
It looks like a crawling inside.
Probably not. It's a little tiny opening, so it would not be able to get in there.
But aren't bees attracted to the nectar? And then how do they get the nectar?
Well, they collect nectar, but they also collect pollen. And so,
I thought the pollen was kind of a byproduct, they just accidentally picked it up as they were getting the nectar.
Well, it's my understanding, actually, that they go out at different times foraging for different things.
Oh, so they're actually looking for pollen.
So sometimes they actually go out, and you can see I'm not sure if they carry the pollen in their leg sacs. Actually, I think that is where they carry the pollen. They carry the nectar inside their own gut.
Mm-hmm.
I got a question on this one.
Yeah.
Let's say beginning about these two, where they had for the Pacific Northwest as their textbook, and they ran, and they came across this, and they ran it through the key.
It would work.
They become confused.
They get stuck, yeah.
Yeah.
And that happens sometimes. There's quite a bit of hybridization that happens in nature. And so occasionally you do encounter a hybrid and it doesn't work in the key.
So on your former slide, I think if you look down there in the lower left-hand corner, is that different?
Yeah, this is something else. This down here is called partridge foot. And so we're discussing the heather, but this is growing next to it.
Okay.
See how open, very different flower.
I thought maybe it was a different stage of the flower.
Yeah, I saw that when I was looking at it. I think, oh, there's some partridge foot down there. But that's what that is. And you can't, I don't think we can see the leaves of it.
Yeah, it has very different shaped leaves. That's actually in the rose family. This is in the heathers are in the heath family, which includes huckleberries and blueberries and quite a few other things. So there's our hybrid. Now, another characteristic, besides number of parts and fusion of parts, is symmetry, another variable. And there's two basic types of symmetry. One is bilateral. Like, we're bilaterally symmetrical, more or less. We can be divided in two halves that are about the same. And some flowers have that same characteristic. They have this bilateral symmetry. That seems to be an adaptation for the nervous system of bees, that bees are attracted to bilateral symmetry. And so it tells us something about the nervous system of the bee. The more common condition is radial symmetry, where pieces can be cut into pie-shaped pieces that are the same. Like way back at the beginning, I'm not going to flip, I think it'd make you dizzy if I flip all the way back, but those early flowers had radial symmetry. This is a monkey flower, yellow monkey flower, which is common in the mountains here, and there's some growing up near a lot of the stream crossings. They're kind of like moist areas. And there's yellow ones, and then there's also a purple a monkey flower. And this is a violet type of stream bank violet, and it also has bilateral symmetry. See, it has these two sides which are different. And then sometimes there's very great specialization. I'll just write down specialization because we have all different kinds of special structure. For pollination. And this is a mountain lady slipper. It's probably our showiest orchid in Washington. Common in the mountains. Well, I can't say common. Common in some places. And here's a close-up of it. In this case, this is the calyx, these pieces right here. And the corolla has been modified into this moccasin shape. And it's also called moccasin flower. At least in the Midwest, there's some species of lady slipper, or the genus of Cypripedium, which is called moccasin flower. This is an insect trap. The insects get caught down in here, and in the process of getting out, they accomplish pollination. This is an even closer view of that.
Is that better or worse?
No, that's good. That's great. Mountain lady slipper. Another orchid that we have around here is called Calypso. And this is actually, how many people are from Washington? Is there anybody from Minnesota? Isn't that something? Oh, we have one back there. This grows in Minnesota too, Calypso. Calypso orchid. Very specialized flower structure. This is another local orchid called coral root. This isn't the topic of today, but coral roots are what are commonly called saprophytes. They don't have any photosynthesis. So this orchid is parasitizing green plants through the medium of a fungus. And those are the same species. Almost all the ones you encounter are this red color, but very occasionally there's an individual that is yellowish like that, and there's just some gene that's present in that individual. or some gene configuration that gives it that odd color. But you can even see the spots. It's the same species. And this is another highly specialized flower structure. This is a type of lousewort. It's kind of a funny name, but this is called birdbeak lousewort.
Oh, yeah.
And you can see it looks kind of like a birdbeak. These are fairly common in the subalpine basins around here. There's another one that looks very much like it that's called elephant head. And it's got this part of the corolla that looks like an elephant trunk. And another part that's like these great big ears, like an African elephant. Now this is a clematis, which grows around here in the kind of middle elevations. And what I wanted to point out about this is another example of where the calyx becomes the part that attracts the insects. This is actually the calyx, not the corolla. And the corolla is absent. Sometimes the whole inflorescence serves as the attractant of the pollinator. And this is a type of saxifrage which doesn't have any petals. Petals have been lost. The calyx is not very showy either. Just kind of greenish, but the whole thing together is big enough and bright enough so that it acts to attract the pollinator. Here's a close-up of it. This is a kind of swamp saxifrage.
Oops, wrong.
Which,
is that good?
Try turning
it's
it.
Gonna get?
Might be. Yeah, that's a little bit there. That's a little better. But you can see that whole thing, that whole inflorescence, acts as something that the insects can see and be attracted to. Someone asked about wind pollination. Well, I just put this grass in to show that grasses are flowering plants, and because they're pollinated by the wind, they don't have any showy calyx and corolla, but they still have the two main working parts, male and female, of a flowering plant. Sometimes the inflorescence serves as the, together, all the flowers together serve as a pollinator. This is that family we looked at, sunflower family. These are the disc flowers, and these are the ray flowers in that composite head. This is sort of to show that the function of all of these flowers is to attract pollinators. And it must be a good system, and it works, and one gets the idea, and pretty soon everybody's doing it. So you got this, I thought it was kind of nice choreography, these three bumblebees.
That's a great dish.
On three stalks of goldenrod. So the goldenrod must be putting out some pollen or nectar today. It's another case. This is a different family. This is in the parsley family, but it's an inflorescence where each of these little parts is a flower. In fact, you can even see it's a five-parted flower. They're not quite open, but there's five petals. And it also is successful in attracting a bee. It's a bumblebee. Bumblebees are probably the primary pollinator in the mountains here. We don't have honeybees. We have a lot of flies that carry out pollination, and also moths and butterflies. And there she is, flying away. Whatever she got. Whatever she wanted, she got. This is a big-headed clover, which is a sagebrush species. But here's another case where a single flower doesn't have the attractive power that a whole inflorescence does. So here you might have dozens of flowers that arrange themselves together. And if we were to dissect one flower out, we'd find that it has stamens and pistils and calyx and corolla. Now, sometimes the role of attracting pollinators is taken over by leaves. And this is a case where this is a skunk cabbage. This is the inflorescence right here. And each of these little bumps, they're not open yet, I don't believe. These are the flowers. And this is called a spadix. This is actually a leaf that becomes bright yellow and serves as an attractant. And this leaf is a type of bract, modified leaf. This is another example. This is an Indian paintbrush. And very showy flowers, but most of that red is not the flower at all. They're leaves, modified leaves that surround the flowers. And the flower itself is a fairly, you can't see too well in this picture, but it's a fairly obscure green structure that's in the middle of all this red. And this is our last example. This is called bunchberry, or Canadian dogwood. And we have three species in Washington. Two of them have these big white leaves, which serve the purpose of attracting. So the flowers, it's many flowers in a tight inflorescence. And then these leaves surround the inflorescence. And this is a close-up of the same thing. Okay.
Is there any edelweiss native in the United States?
There isn't edelweiss. There's a couple different things that have a similar appearance. One of them is called pearly everlasting. And both edelweiss and pearly everlasting are in the sunflower family. And they have a series of leaves or bracts that surround the inflorescence. And those bracts don't wither. They stay, they're white. And they tend to stay when the flowers are all gone. So the things that look like edelweiss are similar to them. Okay? Let's turn on the light here.
You want this just turned to the light?
Yeah, you could do that. That'd be great. Thank you. Well, we're kind of out of time. So we aren't going to get to go through the key. We could, if you want, we have 15 minutes before lunch. If you'd like to stick around after the, we'll end the class at the appropriate time. But if you want to stick around, I have some hand lenses, and we could tear apart one of these daisy heads and look at the two kinds of flowers. The gray flowers and the disc flowers. I guess one thing what's your question first?
I'm one of the ones that a few students that was totally overwhelmed by 50 families. We had to put together a collection of 50 families.
Oh, yeah. But you had a whole quarter to do
it. A whole quarter to do it.
Yeah,
exactly.
I tried to do it 1 hour. So.
Are you saying we didn't have to travel to all ends of the state to do it? We could have done it just in this one valley?
Oh, yeah. I don't remember exactly. I think we had the number that sticks in my head is 64 families in the valley, across the lake,
across the ridge.
This key that I made, which you're welcome to keep if you'd like, if you're interested in it, is only for the 20 most common families. So it's not going to help you with any other families, but. There's something on the order of 220 families, I believe, in Washington. But most of them are very small. These 20 that are in this list are the biggest and most widespread.
So they're all reflected in that other book there.
In this book here?
And in both,
yeah. Oh, yeah, all 20 are in there. This has more than just the 20 big ones. Last thing I'll just point out for an end, there's three things growing in, or three things that I picked for this bouquet. These three are all noxious weeds, all three of them. There's one that's called butter and eggs, there's this oxeye daisy, and this is a foxglove. And they're all three species that are fairly invasive
and that the Forest Service has designated as species they'd like to remove.
Foxglove is on the list?
Foxglove is on the list too. In some places, there's different ways of designating what's noxious. And the Forest Service, being a federal agency, has their own, they're not subject to state law, they have their own classification.
Noxious meaning to your digestion, or obnoxious meaning basically?
No, it's because it's invasive.
Oh, okay.
And tend to crowd out the native species.
Oh, so we're introduced.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's it for today. If you want to stick around, we can try to work through this.
Thanks. Very nice.
Is this article of yours?
Oh, was it?